So thanks. That was a very interesting talk, and I'm not going to really get into the issue of carbon storage in my talk today, although I think it's relevant in terms of relating the effects of land conversion on carbon stores and how that might impact our ability to store carbon in the landscape. It's obviously very relevant to the questions I'm looking at in this simple project today, but I'm really not getting into that in this talk. I thought it was a very interesting talk about the carbon credits and some of the challenges in actually making a program work where you get credited for the carbon. We also have to understand, obviously, about carbon cycling. We've had some great talks here this morning. And today what I'm going to talk about is what happens to carbon in some subtropical ecosystems in Florida when the land is converted. We've had several talks, and the one we just had talked about carbon. This map shows about the importance of carbon storage from a carbon sequestration point of view. What this map shows is the distribution of carbon stores in the United States of America. And what you can see, do I have a pointer, by the way? Oh, there it is. Obviously, the north central states have a tremendous amount of carbon storage. Some other states have significant storage. Florida is a state that has a significant amount of carbon storage, including some of areas that have the greatest carbon storage per meter squared of any ecosystems in North America, down here in the Everglades system. This map shows is another thing about the Florida system. It is a major state for carbon storage overall, but it has quite a lot of variability. It has everything from these central sandy ridge soils that have virtually no carbon storage, you know, of any significance, versus these wetland systems, primarily wetland systems of South Florida, that have quite a lot of carbon storage. The study sites I'm going to talk to you about today are actually on the edge of this central ridge in Florida, some hardwood swamp systems, many of which have been converted into other kinds of land use. And one of the major conversions of land use in the region is towards crop production, but primarily pasture. And what that opportunity that opens up is you can examine the carbon 13 signature, because we're shifting from a plant communities that are dominated by C3 versus C4 plants. I just want to give you an overview here of the sites I'm talking about. This is a site in that region that I showed on the previous map. This is a 1958 aerial photo. You can see this swamp over here, this hardwood swamp. It kind of ends abruptly at the fence line. In fact, in 1940, that swamp extended. You can almost see where it was out here into this area. And what you have is a seepage slope off the central ridge of Florida where bayhead swamps developed along the edge. And these are dominated by things like red maple, bay trees, several different species of bay tree, and they're very dense swamps. And then they open up into what was formerly marsh or grassland, and many of these have been converted. You can see here, the first site I'm going to have in this study was at Buck Island Ranch, where I work. You see a remnant swamp here in 1958. Well, it was removed in the late 70s, we think. I have to do actually more work with the aerial photos to get narrower on the date. But this is a photo from 2004 showing you that swamp has been converted primarily to C4 grassland, dominated by native species such as Andropogon virginicus, bahia grass, Paspalum notatum, and other species. An adjacent site then, on the adjacent property, the Cherry Ranch, they've had some conversion, and you have areas where you still have some remnant patches of swamp, but it's interspersed by C4 grassland. And I estimate, again, I have to get into the aerial photos. It takes quite a lot of work to drill down and find all the photos, and they aren't taken every year, so the best you can do is get an estimate. We think this Cherry site, most of this conversion probably happened in the 1960s, and the Buck Island, we think, was probably in the late 70s that this was finally converted, where all of the hardwood trees were removed and C4 grasses became established as the dominant community. Another ranch, here's a ranch that you can see. They established pasture here where they cut out of the swamp. And so this is the next site we looked at. One of the problems in looking for land conversion is that a lot of this conversion is no longer taking place. So what you're finding is you're finding remnant swamps that exist still today that are adjacent to grassland areas. Well, there's a reason those areas are remnants. And the reason they're remnants is probably they were probably the most inaccessible. They're probably the wettest. So it's very difficult, actually, to get a nice replicated study where you are comparing areas that were converted that are exactly like the area next to them. There's probably a reason why they stopped cutting the woods here, and it probably just got a little bit too wet for them. So that's a problem in this study, any kind of ecosystem study like this where you're looking at land use conversion, you didn't set up the experiment yourself, you're going to run into those kind of problems. So that's a caveat in my results here. Stable isotopes are obviously very useful. We had a talk previously and today that talked about C13. I did at least want to give an overview for those who maybe aren't as familiar with the technology. The stable isotope C13 exists in a very low concentration in the atmosphere, but different environmental samples, particularly different plant species, have different signals. And part of the reason they have a different signal, and the way we determine this Del-13 is by comparing a sample, the isotopic ratio of C13 to C12. In a sample, it's compared to a mineral standard that's used in the C13 world, and that gives you the Del-13. How different is the sample from your standard, basically, is what you're looking at. And C4 species, because they have these bundle sheets and this unique processing, physiological processing of carbon, they are actually able to, because of this extra cycle they have, they're actually able to close their stoma and use a carbon at a much lower partial pressure. So what that enables them to do is actually incorporate more C13 into their tissue. So corn and other C4 plants, the C4 grasses I'm talking about today, they have a higher amount of C13 in their tissue. Essentially, they're less depleted in C13 relative to this standard. And because of that, C13, wherever there's been a shift in vegetation, whether it's a cornfield from a forest or in perhaps cases that are more relevant to mine where tropical forests have been converted to cattle pasture, people have used these shifts in vegetation to look at C13. That's not a novel thing. And the way that's done is to, here we have a situation originally where the entire community was C3 plants, and therefore all the carbon in the soil was derived from C3 plants. You shift to a new community, in this case almost one that's dominated almost exclusively by C4, then you have a buildup of carbon in the soil that comes from the C4 plus whatever was still there from the C3, and this enables you to make estimates about things like turnover rates and carbon storage in these converted systems. So you have a higher C13, C14 ratio here and a lower one there. And because you have the shift, you can use that as a tool to examine how carbon has changed in these systems over time. So we use these three sites that I already showed you in the historic aerials where this mixed hardwood swamp, essentially, bay swamps we call them, were converted to grassland. We sampled five locations both within the swamp and adjacent grass area, and looked at depth increments. Now, we separated the organic and mineral. Very often, carbon storage numbers are represented on a meter depth of soil. It's one of the standard ways that's done. We have a lot of these soils have an organic layer on top of them, so we sampled that, 0 to 5, 5 to 10, and 10 to whatever the bottom of that was. It was a variable layer. And then did the mineral soil in these increments down to a meter. So we had a meter of carbon storage in the mineral soil and whatever was also in the organic horizon. And then we looked at bulk density, organic matter, loss on ignition, total carbon and nitrogen, and the stable isotopic ratios. This is the data we had, and I worked it up on Friday, so I've gotten a little bit into it, but unfortunately have not gotten to the point where we've actually tried to see if we can calculate turnover rates and that sort of a thing. Here's a picture of one of the sites. This is a typical bay swamp. These are sweet magnolia, sweet bay trees. Fern understory is very common. These are all C3 plants. And then a lot of these areas have been converted to typical C4 pasture. It could be native grasses or introduced forages, but they're mostly all C4s. And this is the kind of cores we got out of the organic layers. And again, we went down to a meter in the mineral soil. So these are the data. Just to show you, when you average across the sites looking at swamp versus pasture, that in fact there's quite a lot of carbon in these soils, and that in general the pasture soils had more carbon in the surface than because of the higher bulk densities in the upper 5 centimeters. But overall, the swamp soils, as you can see here at the lower depths, had significantly more carbon than the pasture sites. And if you look at the totals, you can see that we have in the swamp, on average, among these three sites, 30 kilograms of carbon per meter squared, whereas the pasture is 24. And again, this is 20% lower, but we can't necessarily attribute that to the land use change because of the problems I talked about before. We don't really know how well paired these sites are, and we know that the swamp may have more carbon because it was more inaccessible as a wetter site to begin with. But at any rate, this gives you an idea of the amounts of carbon we had in the systems. And that significant amount of that carbon is in the organic layer. In fact, most of it is in the organic layer, not the mineral soil. Although there is quite a bit still out of meter in some of these systems. Now, if you look at the sites, you'll see, in fact, we have quite a lot of difference among the sites. Two of the sites, as you saw in the aerial photos, were quite close to each other, and they map pretty well. That's the Buck Island site and the Cherry site are very close to one another all the way down. There's a few differences as we get deeper. The Cherry site really had a lot more carbon in it, and particularly this third organic layer was actually deeper. That's why this bar is so much bigger. So this Cherry site had quite a lot. And the Hendry site had quite similar community. The vegetation's very similar, but it's a much different soil. It's a different soil type, and that soil order has a much different capacity to store carbon, as you can see here. What you have is basically the organic muck layer that's developed under the swamp or whatever vegetation you have with very organic, poor mineral soils underlying. So you actually have very low carbon storage, you know, relative to the other sites of the Hendry site. Buck Island and Cherry are very much similar, but despite the fact that they were just within a quarter mile of one another, they had quite a lot more carbon storage at this site due to these subtle variations in the soil types. So we had quite a range of carbon storage at the sites. And pointing out also, we're still picking up a significant amount of carbon at a 1 meter depth. And very often, this is the far as we go when we look at soil carbon. But people at the University of Florida, like Willie Harris and others, have shown that, in fact, in parts of Florida and other parts of the world, there can be significant carbon storage in these well-drained, leached soils. This is just a profile of a ditch bank here. You can see, you know, 2 meters down, you've got a lot of leached carbon that is accumulating in the deeper layers. So some of these sites might have had carbon going down quite a great distance that would have contributed significantly to your estimate of total carbon storage. To look at the carbon inputs, what the C13 signal was on those, we had, as you would expect, the bay swamp had very depleted carbon signal, whereas the pasture had much more would be expected of C4. And if we look at the C13 signal, you can see here at the Hendry site, which we think is the longest site, we have the most enrichment of C13 and to the greatest depth, as we'd expect. The other sites, Cherry, we think, is the second oldest. It has more enrichment than the Buck Island site, which we think was the most recently converted. So as we expected, we see the shift in carbon, and we also see that the sites that have been around the longest or converted the longest have the most contribution of the C13. And here you can see the amount of carbon. This is the percentage that comes from the C4 in these two different layers. The surface soil at the Hendry site, nearly 75% of that carbon at the pasture is from grass, the new grass, whereas down at the Buck Island site, only about 16% is. Oddly enough, although there was 40% in the 5-centimeter layer at the Hendry site, there's very little getting down below that. And then we have this peak down below. So these patterns don't always come out clear, and it can be hard to interpret them sometimes. But in general, we see the pattern in the surface soil that we expected to see. Now, why do we have this shift with depth? Other people have noticed that in forest soils, where you're getting more enriched in the native soils as you go deeper. Well, on the surface, it might be due in part to the fact that there's been a 1 mil shift since the 1800s due to fossil fuel burning. That could account for this shift here. But why there's this other shift, it may be due to fractionation during geochemical transformations. Here for CO2, you see that's not the case. It's the wrong direction. But for methane, in fact, methane, there's quite a lot of depletion in methane. And I'm wondering if part of the reason you see that shift in more enrichment as you go deeper is because of long historical conversion due to methane. Others in the audience who know more about methanogenesis might speak to that. But clearly there's a shift over time due to some kind of depletion of the lighter or less enriched carbon. So in conclusion, I want to say here that clearly the Bayhead swamps have a lot of carbon storage, but there's quite a bit of variation among sites, and the soil type seems to drive that more than the vegetation. The shifts in the soil C13 did reflect the vegetation shifts, including what I think are the time scenarios, which I hope to narrow down more as I look at more of the aerial photos. But not all the patterns were clear. At one site, we didn't see nearly any enrichment at the 10-centimeter level, which I would have expected, and then we saw more enrichment at depth. And so there's clearly some problems associated with interpreting these patterns. We saw increasing C13 enrichment with depth, as observed for other forest soils, and I think that's still a question out there, is why we see this shift with depth. And hopefully over time that'll become clarified. But in conclusion, I think these changes in C13 are very useful for, as nature's recorders, for helping us to make carbon turnover rates, which I hope to do once I get a better finger on the time scales of these shifts, and also just to examine historic shifts in vegetation in these subtropical systems, which at one time were very dominated by wetlands, But since we've drained the landscape and established a lot of pasture and other ecosystems, have been converted to a new ecosystem type dominated by C4s, and I think it'll be a very useful tool to work in a lot of these different systems in this particular region. So with that, I would thank you for your attention and be glad to take any questions you might have.